This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. You're listening to an extended episode, available exclusively to FM Plus or premium subscribers, with your host, Craig Danieloff.
In this episode, we're going to continue our talk with Michael Gray about the content in the new release of his Song and Dance Man book, Language and Tradition. As many of you know, Song and Dance Man was first released 50 years ago and has been updated several times, and it's widely praised as the best book on Bob Dylan ever written. Greil Marcus called it extraordinarily useful. Rolling Stone called it monumental. Christopher Ricks said it was immensely illuminating. The reason these and dozens of other top publications and nearly every Dylan freak in the world love it is because what Michael Gray does in this book is explain or unpack the writing, the singing, the performance, the exact things that we all love about Dylan, but most of us can't explain and really don't understand. Of course, Michael would never say that he explains Dylan. That's my word. But he certainly breaks down the techniques, relates what Dylan does to other artists and writers, and along the way reveals things about Dylan and these songs that certainly feel like revelations. In our podcasts, talking about chapters 1, 2, and 3, we talk through the book's analysis of how Dylan took from and related to folk music, literature, and rock and roll, respectively. We've seen there that in example after example, in each area, there were other artists whose work clearly educated and informed and influenced Bob Dylan. We've also seen how Dylan's timeline, the particular years in history when he was growing up and starting his career, had a very precise impact on what he was exposed to and therefore what he knew, who he knew, and how he was affected by the culture around him. To be clear, it's not like some magic trick is being revealed. What Bob did is still miraculous, and Michael Gray would be, and in fact was, the first to say so. But it also becomes evident that that work did not occur in a vacuum. As we've seen, there were dozens or hundreds or thousands of connections to the world around him, all of which makes Dylan much more interesting. Having this context can change the way you listen to Dylan and how you enjoy him, if you want it to. It gives us many threads to pull if we want to know or think about or investigate further. In this episode, we're starting chapter 4. This chapter is about the journey Bob takes from singing linguistically simple folk songs in 1961 and 62 to singing complex and what are often called surrealistic songs by 65 and 66. As with anything Dylan, it's not a straight line. And again, the chapter is stuffed with context and examples and insights, which serve to give an even greater appreciation for the phenomenal evolution that Dylan went through in those 5 or 6 years. This part of the story is rich and compelling, and we could even fit it into one podcast. So this is part 1, and in part 2, we'll finish our discussion of chapter 4. After that, we'll move on to the companion chapter 5, which digs into how Dylan turned next to the language of simplicity on the albums that followed, John Wesley Harding, Nashville Skyline, New Morning, and even the Basement Tapes. If you're reading along with us, that's great. But I think these work well to listen before or after reading. And just like the book, they may be things you want to revisit more than once. A link to the new edition of the book, which is available in paperback and Kindle at Amazon, is in the show notes. As before, we're going to go through this chapter talking and listening to excerpts before getting Michael's commentary. Our special guest reader for these two episodes is Anne Margaret Daniel, Venetian Blonde Online, and one of my favorite Dylan writers and people. Anne Margaret teaches at the New School in NYC and at Bard College, and I'll link to a few of her spectacular pieces on Bob Dylan and her website where you can find even more. Trust me, these are things you'll want to read. Anne Margaret has edited several volumes of F. Scott Fitzgerald, including the W.W. Norton edition of The Great Gatsby. Check her website out for details and links. And now, here's my conversation with Song and Dance Man author Michael Gray, We're talking about Chapter 4, Dylan's use of language towards complexity. This chapter is about the complexity in Dylan's language, and it was written to point out an evolution in the songwriting and how he, you know, started one way, went another, came back, and you sort of chart this course that winds up documenting what we'll see is a very short period of the 60s.
It's very short in terms of actual time, but in terms of the importance of Bob Dylan becoming Bob Dylan and changing the world of song, it's a very long period because there's so much in it. You know, the Bob Dylan of 1962 does some great stuff, but by 1964, that's a long time away in existential terms, you know, because he has done so much already. And then from 64 to 65 and so on, you know, I mean, now we look back and it's like, you know, I was shocked quite recently to realize that the 30th anniversary so-called celebration that Columbia Records did was 30 years ago. And that last 30 years, well, you know, not much has happened in many ways. Obviously, in other ways, you know, things get faster and faster. But in terms of Dylan's career, you know, his career has moved more slowly through the last 30 years than it's impossible to compare that to the first 10 years in which so much happens. So much happens from the guy who breaks through with the extraordinariness of Blowing in the Wind at the time compared to what was the context. And then, you know, only 3 years later, it's 1965. And look at what he's done in between. Amazing.
It's funny, as you talk about that, I was thinking it'd be interesting through some mathematical formula to normalize the periods. In other words, one unit is this amount of change.
Yes.
So like, you know, 2000 through 2007 is like an inch, but
yes,
August 62 to February 63 is 7 units or something.
Yes. Yeah.
That's what the first section of this chapter, and it's interesting because the chapter is about complexity, but you start it by grounding in how he got there, which was you know, simplicity before.
And traditional song, and then kind of tweaking traditional song. In some ways, he does this in a very straightforward way. You know, A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall comes from Lord Franklin. There's nothing particularly modern in the vocabulary of A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, and yet there's something extraordinarily contemporary when he comes out with it. Especially at the time for those people who knew him as this little punk who stole their records and, you know, drank too much Beaujolais and so on. How could that little guy, you know, come up with this amazing song? So, yes, at that point, there's in 62, he's already doing extraordinary things with traditional song and therefore with traditional language. Of course, one of the things I want to say about this chapter is it has the benefit of having started out and been largely created almost contemporaneously with the Dylan work. In other words, I'm writing this stuff in 1970, 71, published first in 72, 73. And so I've been living through this stuff as it arrived, as it was new. And therefore, you know, for me too, like for any young person, there's all the difference in the world between January and December of any particular formative year that you have. And so when all this stuff is coming in new, hot off the presses, you're very unconscious of how short a space of time it is, what you're conscious of is how much change is happening so fast, or this is a guy who's different all the time.
Well, this is something that I'm sure that anyone would look at differently with 20 years, let alone 50 years. It kind of takes some time to process. And the other thing for all of us, no matter how disciplined of a listener you are, is you listen to a jumble of Dylan, and there's a certain Dylan-ness in all of it. But, you know, you hear Honey, Give Me One More Chance, and you hear Hard Rain, and you hear Desolation Row, and all the steps in between, and your head's not bucketing them. So to go back and look at it and say, well, 60 through 62, let's call it, when he's playing kind of very simple folk and blues, the stuff, you know, largely on Bob Dylan with an exception or two, that's one thing. And as you say, especially the period we get the most analysis and review of people asking about others, like you say, who saw him around and said, well, you know, you saw what he was doing right before he recorded Bob Dylan, and you saw what he was doing 2 years later, and they're all like, you know, some metamorphosis that's unexplained.
It's one of the benefits now of being old. There aren't many, but, you know, the fact that you heard it in real time, and therefore you paid attention to it in real time and had the chronology clear, very clear in your head.
Yeah.
That's good stuff.
There was a guy on Twitter last week or so who was introducing himself to Dylan for the first time, and he had been going chronologically. And he said, I've listened to the first three albums and I've heard nothing else. And I kind of retweeted and said, what amazing discipline, but, you know, compelling things you have ahead.
Yes.
I mean, imagine to actually do that. Because now, you know, we hear a lot from the younger fans who, you know, they take it as a virtue that it's a jumble, that it's just all stuff. But there is something in, you know, imagine you've heard nothing but Freewheeling, you know, Honey, Allow Me One More Chance, Boots of Spanish Leather, Times Are Changing, God on Our Side, Hattie Carroll. You know, what I wrote here is masterful, but not complex in the term we're talking about today. And this is, as you say, you know, it's not the language or the words, and you're better to describe this than me, but it's the construction that's as clearly sets them apart as some of the later techniques. But that's basically 63, 64. So this is where you start by praising and highlighting examples where the non-complex language is special nonetheless. So here's our first excerpt from the book.
I think the admirable David Horowitz accepts too readily that Dylan's articulacy is not so much individual as traditionally skillful. It assumes that Dylan's early work compliantly fits in his non-literal language according to the long-established literary rules. This isn't the case. If you look from the rules to the work Dylan has produced, you get entangled in listing Dylan's failures, or to put it another way, in emphasizing Dylan's lack of sophistication in handling language, or in defensively referring to his instinctive talents. Such entanglement will reveal, in fact, not Dylan's faults, but a wrong perspective on the listener's or critic's part. Full as Dylan's work is of unsophisticated imagery, the success, the eloquence, and impact of such language in Dylan's hands challenges any weighting of sophistication as an evaluative term.
I can remember people at the time saying all this stuff, you know, how clumsy his phrasing was or his language was. He was very unsophisticated. He didn't polish his verses properly and so on. And obviously now, and it seemed to me even at the time, this was just looking through the wrong end of the telescope, you know. Look at how successful that unsophisticated work is. Look at the virtue that comes from that clumsiness, that so-called clumsiness, you know. And the chapter gives many examples of that, and obviously, you know, does so more carefully and with greater precision than I can do sitting here now. But yeah, it was part of his. It was part of what was, you know, the general sneering at him by people who thought they understood the purity of folk music. And of course, anyone who was more inclined towards good literature.
Yeah, you made a version of this point last time we talked about the fact that as educated as he was, the word ain't was not used sloppily. It was intentional. So some comments now from another passage in the book about Song to Woody, the Dylan original that we've talked about a little bit before.
Dylan uses conventional, figurative language to equal effect in one of the very earliest of his published compositions, Song to Woody, where he takes the obvious but worthwhile step of personifying the funny old world, which, quote, seems sick and it's hungry, it's tired and it's torn, looks like it's a dying and it's hardly been born. This ultra simplicity of imagery is partnered frequently by an opposite sort of quality to one of overriding anger. Partnered, that is, by an understatement. There is no anger here, and nothing complex either, but the effectiveness is undeniable.
But yeah, I mean, you know, a simple thing like taking the world to be like a person, talking about it as a person, seems sick and it's hungry, it's tired and it's torn, looks like it's the dying and it's hardly been born. You know, this is technically called the pathetic fallacy. You know, where the sun is shining benignly on you, or the clouds are weeping. You know, I mean, these are conventional devices, and Dylan is using them conventionally, therefore, and yet he manages a freshness in the way that he does things. There was a whole period, actually, and I think I deal with this in the chapter, around 63, 64, not all the songs that are on the albums, but there are a whole bunch of those songs where the night shatters, walls crumble. There's almost a sort of period in his writing where all those senses are mixed, not in a kind of Baudelairean colors seem like sounds and all that stuff, but just things bouncing off walls and this being his heartbeat and so on. I mean, I think even in that song about the one where he sings, he's playing his guitar and he's watching this girl in the room.
How does what Dylan does with that in Song to Woody, is that consistent in many of the songs he's covering at the time, or is he adding a spark of something new there?
I think he adds a spark of something new there. I mean, it just sounds, and it always did, it sounded quirkily him.
The first Dylan-esque.
It's partly to do with how he delivers the line, of course. He delivers it better on that recording than in any time he's revisited it.
Hey, hey, Woody Guthrie, I wrote you a song about a funny old world that's a-coming along. Seems sick and it's hungry, it's tired and it's torn. It looks like it's a dying and it's hardly been born.
And, you know, we've talked before, I think, about how there are some things in Dylan which they were so fresh at the time, it's impossible to rehear that freshness now. I know Harry Hugh mentioned this in his talk at the Dylan World of Dylan. And I've talked about it myself in other places. You know, when you hear a 1965 audience listening to Love Minus Zero, No Limit, and the simple thing of him saying, people talk over situations, draw conclusions on the wall, the audience laughs. It's so fresh then. How would anyone who grew up later than that possibly find that so fresh as to be strikingly funny? You know, it wouldn't be, but it was then. And I think the same kind of slightly weird individual take on things is audible, and therefore in the lyric of even an early song like Song to Woody. Yeah, of course, that's a song we talked about in an earlier podcast, the brilliance of that song. But in terms of what we're talking about now, I think it's individually quirky. I mean, I can't imagine anyone else singing that line about the world being, seems like it's dying and it's hardly been born. If somebody more sophisticated sang it, it would sound patronizing. It would sound artificial. If somebody less savvy than Bob Dylan sang it, it might seem artificially cute.
Let's look at Hollis Brown a few years later as another example of a different kind of effectiveness without complexity.
Consider, too, the simple effectiveness of the imagery in his Ballad of Hollis Brown. Here, the words are so riveting and so didactically visual that Dylan can even afford to echo the nursery rhyme about the crooked man without this distracting us. You look for work and money, and you walk a ragged mile. You look for work and money, and you walk a ragged mile. Neither are we distracted when we come to an apparently histrionic analogy like this. Your wife's screams are stabbing like the dirty driving rain. The very lack of balance in the construction of that analogy enforces its realism. It is a way of the narrator saying, I understand your desperation, your imbalance.
I'm not sure I explained that terribly well with that. The wife's screams are stabbing like the dirty driving dirty rain. Does dirty driving rain feel like you're being stabbed when you're pushing your way through it? I don't know, but he risks it. He risks it because obviously you could leave it at the wife's screams are stabbing you, but you know the song has to flow on. And it's a mixed metaphor, if you like. But Dylan, it occurs to me now that Dylan uses rain so effectively in so many songs. You know, even in a far more recent and apparently trivial example, like where he talks about the rain follows the train. And you kind of think, what? And then, yeah, you know, sometimes you're on a train and the rain does follow. You know, it's not necessarily going in the opposite direction or splatting against the window, you know. Someone could write a learned thesis about Dylan's use of rain. I mean, obviously, Hard Rain is a particular case, but here we have, you know, Hollis Brown, and as I say, yeah, there's a quirkiness to the way that Dylan messes up, if you like, rain and stabbing, driving rain and a scream that is stabbing. It's an odd combo. You wouldn't normally think of someone screaming. You can imagine, you know, it's fairly conventional to have it a really piercing sound, like being stabbed by this sound, but then to compare it to driving rain is a whole other thing. The nursery rhyme thing, you know, that one there was a crooked man and he walked a crooked mile, and Dylan risks reminding you of that nonsense in a song which is designed to evoke the desperation of these starving people. It's brave.
There's seven breezes blowing all around the cabin door. There's seven breezes blowing all around the cabin door. Seven shots ring out like the ocean's pounding roar. There's seven people dead on a South Dakota farm. There's seven people dead on a South Dakota farm. Somewhere in the distance, there's seven new people born.
Yeah, I think this song really stands out in many ways. It's not actually been one of my favorite songs, and yet it's clearly extremely effective.
Yeah. And I don't know anyone who would say it was was one of their favorite songs. But yeah, it's extremely effective.
But all the way to MTV Unplugged. I mean, and later it you know he didn't put it away, despite I think it's very unique in the canon.
Yeah. And the ending, of course. The ending, the bleakness of the ending, you know, there's no solace in the fact that somewhere in the distance there are seven new people born. And the implication is they're going to have just as miserable a life as these people who are just ending their lives.
But I think for the purpose of this, what we're talking about here, it's another example of without sophistication of language, Dylan finds other techniques to be, you know, effectiveness is the word you use here, but to be compelling and communicative. We're setting ourselves up for the sophisticated language to come and showing he managed without it. So next one that you had mentioned a little bit already, and there's a long coverage in the book, but I'm just going to read a little bit about Hard Rain, because it's another one where you dissect the techniques that did interrely on sophistication that are yet compelling.
As for A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, it is true that to a very large extent, Dylan's use of images is dictated by a tradition, but it surely builds to a distinctive whole. Line upon line, the pictures are piled up, some containing their own moral via paradox. I saw a newborn babe with wild wolves all around it. I saw guns and sharp swords in the hands of young children. Heard one person starve, I heard many people laughing. The most interesting thing, perhaps, in terms of Dylan's achievement is that although the fifth verse draws morals almost specifically, although the deliberate fragmentedness of the other verses does fit into a cohesive moral theme, the effectiveness of this theme still depends on the pictures rolling past, as if on and then off a screen, without opportunity of recall. In other words, there's a simple, strange sense in which for the song as a whole to succeed, each image within it asserts a segregated life of its own.
Yeah, you know, in other words, in some lines, you get the contrast within one line. Newborn babe with wild wolves all around it. Other times it takes two lines to say that. But in each case, you know, he is following one thing with another. It's a list song. I mean, he's good at list songs, but and some people feel that's a rather easy way of writing a song. You know, everything is broken. Might not be, you know, the most magnificent and sophisticated achievement of Dylan's career, but in this case, there's something so powerful about the sort of the implication that this is visionary, this song. And that is achieved by the way that bang, 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 line after line, verse after verse, you know. What did you hear? Bloody blah. What did you see? I don't know now how much I agree with the idea that one thing has to sort of disappear immediately from your consciousness in order to hear the next bit. But I think on the whole, the song manages to use, a traditional structure and in many ways, not particularly surprising images. A newborn baby is obviously a conventionally vulnerable creature. Wild wolves are, you're not inventing something striking like, I don't know, rabid hippopotami or something, you know. Wild wolves is fairly conventional stuff. And yet, it adds up to this extraordinary visionary quality. Yeah. Without any particular literary sophistication.
It's a trick that they're so compelling, yet built out of standard parts.
Yeah.
Because the list works because you never get bored, because at every step, the list is interesting apart from the cumulative.
Yes.
We're still in 63, 64 here, and another side of Bob Dylan comes out, and the songs are in some ways of the same character. All I Want to Do, Back Pages, It Ain't Me, Ramona. And we're now kind of through the folk, the old folk, the contemporary folk, the personal songs, the finger pointing in protest. And we've been through all those phases in kind of 3 years to our original point of how fast things went. And I don't think most people looking back would say, you know, finger pointing was 18 months, or I'm not sure that's exactly what it is, but it's close to that. Go ahead.
I don't like that phrase, finger pointing songs, because actually, who is he pointing a finger at in any of those songs? No one in particular. You know, he's talking about America. He's talking about the Western world. He's not very often accusing, sometimes he mocks particular bunches of people like John Birch Society. Finger pointing songs probably include Times They Are Changing, where he is naively appealing to senators and congressmen to please heed the call. That's not finger pointing.
I think the finger pointing is, it's his word, I think, is a reference to the position or the posture of the person saying it, meaning someone making that point is a guy with his finger out.
Okay.
I don't know. I have never thought, about whether it was the pointer or the pointee that was important there.
Finger pointing songs would include the dramatic monologue songs, the songs where he's attacking one specific person and they never get a chance to answer back, like Ballad of a Thin Man, you know, or indeed Like a Rolling Stone. He's jabbing a finger there, whereas even in a song that is cataloguing the awfulness of contemporary life, like It's All Right, Ma, I'm Only Bleeding, he's not directing that finger at anyone in particular. In fact, It's All Right, Ma, I'm Only Bleeding.
Yeah. It was the general public. It was the do-gooder kind of songs and almost antithetically, not personal. Whereas, you know, on another side.
Side of Bob Dylan, that really makes some changes. I mean, first of all, My Back Pages, that's really grappling with how limited it was to be singing those songs in which things were black and white. And then, of course, the great song on the fourth album is Chimes of Freedom. This is a transitional song in terms of his use of language, is it not? Because on the one hand, quite clearly, it is a lament for what is wrong with our society and and therefore our lives. And at the same time, it's not a simple song. The language is not, it doesn't have the clarity of, you know, a simple song.
Yeah, I think that one's particularly interesting because while there really aren't protest songs on this album, that's the most outwardly facing. Although we know from Joan Baez that it was inspired by a personal, you know, issue. I don't know if you've heard this story, but she says, I know that story,
and I have very little patience for it because because you know, someone who is rejected from a hotel room or whatever it was does not go home in a sulk and write something as powerful and general and unpersonally wounded as that song. So come on.
Well, most Joan. People certainly wouldn't.
And one of the best ways to appreciate the power of Chimes of Freedom, it seems to me, is to listen to the recording of his first live performance of it in London in 1964.
Oh,
and
okay.
It's from one of his most powerful solo concerts at Percival Hall, and he's so focused on it that you hear it anew, however many times you think you've heard it.
Far between the finished sundown and midnight's broken toll, we ducked inside the doorway as thunder went crashing. As majestic bells of bolts struck shadows in the sounds, seeming to be the chimes of freedom flashing, flashing for the warriors.
It's quite a contrast to the sort of opaque way in which he delivered it at the Bill Clinton inauguration concert.
We gaze inside the doorway, thunder crashing. As a thousand bolts strike lightning through the sound, seeming to be the chimes of freedom flashing, flashing for the warrior.
But it does mark on this album, along with Spanish Harlem Incident, which we'll talk about, a bit of this turn of in terms of sophistication. And in the book, actually, there's this passage we'll hear now where you identify this as kind of an early sign of changes coming. And it's interesting because even as we break these things down and draw lines about this year or this month, the reality is more complex and there's leaps forward and reversals. Until at some point he's in a new place, but it wasn't a switch that got turned. But here's what you say in the book.
So far, I've focused on a general simplicity in Dylan's language, but Dylan is far more famous, albeit due to misconceptions on the whole, for the antithesis of this, a complexity of language that runs over, so the charge goes, into the positively obscure. Another side of Bob Dylan begins the development of the new complexity. The first hints of it come earlier. The previous album, The Times They Are Changin', offers an interesting example of poetic transference. On the beautiful One Too Many Mornings, the attributes of one thing are transferred onto another, and the silent night will shatter from the sounds inside my mind. The prose equivalent, stripped of this transference, would be that the silence of the night will be shattered. As Dylan has it, the night will shatter. The transference succeeds. It comes across as forceful and unforced. It urges the inseparability of the night and the silence. It gives us creatively and with a terse economy the idea that if the night were no longer silent, it would not be the same night.
Question is, in retrospect or at the time, how the transition took place, that he discovered little capabilities, or he found a song that needed something new and started to create what he needed. And that as we go back, we can go, okay, well, this album's mostly this, but that and that are in it.
Yes.
And later that and that are giant.
Yeah. That's quite a nice example of how this period in his work works. The silent night will shatter from the sounds inside my mind. He's fusing the outside world and the inside his head world. And he does it in such a natural way, with such a simplicity of language, and yet it's not so simple, is it?
Right. And had it been... And had that phrase appeared two albums earlier, it would have stuck out, you know, would have never fit.
I think, yeah.
Let's then go on to Spanish Harlem, because you very clearly point this out. In fact, you say in the book, this is the substantial beginnings of Dylan's famous complexity. And here's a passage, maybe the one that came from.
Thus, with Spanish Harlem Incident, and that fourth album, we find the really substantial beginnings of Dylan's famous complexity, the beginnings of what 1965 brought out with an explosion, the year that saw an amazing, breathtaking burst of prolific creativity, yielding a huge list of great Dylan songs and great Dylan recordings. There is nothing contrived here, as the context and the recording yield up those lines. Swallowed works neatly, and the unobtrusive reversal of the usual teeth and eyes metaphors again strikes the listener as unforced, evoking a real idea of the girl the song addresses. It is in terms of the girl that this near gothic effect works also. The night is pitch black. Come and make my pale face fit into place. Ah, please. For such a girl, the night would make itself dramatic. Again, we feel that the girl's personality draws out this in the final verse.
I've been wondering all about me ever since I seen you there on the cliffs of your wildcat charms I'm riding. I know I'm round you, but I don't know where. You have slayed me, you have made me. I got to laugh halfway off my heels. I got to know, babe, will you surround me so I can know if I am really real?
Comment on what that song did for the first time, and how it maybe, you know, showed us some new skills. I think it's another song that, to me, it you can't sit it next to anything else. I think it's just so singular and spectacular.
It is singular and spectacular. But on the cliffs of your wildcat charms I'm riding. Just think about that, you know. There's a metaphor there which is weird, because you know, wildcat charms is itself a bumping together of two very surprising attributes. You know, the attraction of the woman, young woman who is like a wildcat, that's one thing. But charms are usually demure and you know, not necessarily all that admirable. And yet he bumps that together, your wildcat charms. Maybe that in that case, charms is only there really to come with arms. But on the cliffs of your wildcat charms, I'm riding. It's just crazy. But what it evokes is the kind of mixed up confusion that he's feeling. It's expressing mixed up confusion without, while being a very long way from saying, I got mixed up, confusion, man, it's killing me, you know. It's a long way from that. And altogether, you know, there's all this stuff about her teeth and hands it's a churning, passionate song, and as you say, there's nothing else like it really, and yet it's rushing headlong towards the sort of whirligig surrealism of 1965.
This point, the core point that we talked about, that this bam, bam, bam thing happened with Styles, and the fact that it reveals, what he's able to do, borrowing methodologies and then reconstituting them and then shifting. I think somewhat unintentionally on my part anyway, these songs, Song to Woody, Ballad of Alice Brown, Hard Rain, and then Spanish Harlem, it's almost four examples where Dylan wanted to do something and found or created the tools to do that thing, where almost everyone else says, these are the parts I got. I'm going to make a new song about this topic with those parts. And they sound the same.
Yes,
and Dylan got himself out on a ledge because this is what Woody needed. And this is what Hard Rain needed. And Wildcat Charms.
I think you've expressed that very well yourself.
Well, it's what I read, Michael, in this book I got. Well, thank you again.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening.